Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, grab one of the last tickets to the Northwest Arkansas regional event. That's the first weekend in May. You can hang out with myself and Chad and a whole bunch of other people at that event. If you're looking to hang out with Chad every day, you know what you need to do? Sign up for the Bible in a Year with Chad. Yeah, Chad will take you through that Bible, give you a little insights. You can read along with Chad Bird. There's a link in the show notes, and you can get the information on how to do that. It's a good way to start your year. Also, as you're starting the year, now, Chad and I are not big New Year's resolution guys because, you know, we've lived long enough to know that there's no need to, like, set yourself up for more failure. And so we're not out there looking to make, you know, promises to ourselves that we don't keep. However, though, if you're just looking for something to maybe start doing this new year, how about becoming a supporter of this show and 1517? Hey, that would be a good one. This I am confident you can do because all you got to do is sign up and then you can just become a reoccurring donor. You can just support it for any amount you want. You could start that this year and, you know, you feel like you did. You could feel like you made a commitment and you did it, and you only really have to do it once, and then it just does it for you. And think about how great that will feel at the end of the year when you realize that you did, in fact, do that thing. And so that's what Chad and I are doing this year, you know, supporting 1517. You could join us in that. There's a link for that in the show note as well. We do need your support. That's how all this stuff is available. Helps. Me do my job, helps Chad do his job. It's all funded by people who support the show, support all the other work that Chad does, support 1517. So we appreciate all you those of you who do it. And if you don't and you're able and you would like to, we'd encourage you to do it. All right. By the way, if I sound different today, it's because I'm in a whole different setup, different room, different mic, snowed in. Couldn't make it to the office today. Snowed in, so I'm at my house, and I'm having to do this from home with my home setup, which I haven't used in a long time. Chad knew immediately as we jumped onto the screen here that something had changed. I haven't been in this spot in a while.
I saw that that microphone. I was like, whoa, that is, I haven't seen that microphone in probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. It's been a while.
Yeah, it still works. So here I am, snowed in. And but it's all right. We're coming to you anyway. So I'm coming to you all nestled up and warm. It's cold outside, but we're doing this thing. We are in Job chapter 15. We just finished up with Job giving a long response to Zophar and his other friends and God. He's responding to everybody, and we had some shots of hope. You know, sort of in the midst of a lot of. You know, kind of morbid and lament, but there was some hope in there. Job is sort of daring to hope, catches himself a little bit, says some super true things, and then thinks they're too good to be true, but they are in fact the truth. Well, now we're going to hear from Eliphaz. He's got to sound off again because he heard those words of hope, and he didn't hit his ears well at all.
Yeah, he starts out by basically calling Job a windbag. So not a great way to further the conversation with an insult. But that's the way he starts out. He says, Job 15, should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? Should he argue in unprofitable talk or in words with which he can do no good? But you, here, of course, here he's talking to Job, but you are doing away with the fear of God and hindering meditation before God. For your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, and not I. Your own lips testify against you. So yeah, he starts out with the insult. I mean, you're basically just full of the wind. You're a windbag, Job. That's all you are. You filled your belly with the east wind, and now it's coming out your mouth. You got all this unprofitable talk going on. But you know, he starts out that way, but then he actually shifts gears and he accuses Job of not just kind of being full of nothing and being a windbag, but actually directing people away from God. He says, you are doing away with the fear of God. You're hindering meditation before God. And then he says, your iniquity is the instructor of your mouth. So, I mean, it's one thing to say to somebody, oh, you're just, you're full of hot air. It's another thing to say you're full of heresy, or you're full of false teaching, or you're leading people away from God. So Eliphaz has ramped up things here a little bit in his accusations against Job.
Yeah, I mean, what one of the things that's it's one thing to do what he's saying here is like, hey, nice word salad there, Job. There's a lot of words that meant nothing, but I did detect something in those words, and it was that you've completely tossed out the fear of the Lord. That's what you've done. That's a wild thing, right? Like, the only thing you've really done in all your speech is proven that you have no fear of God.
Yeah, it's quite the accusation to make, and I wonder if what's behind it is this idea that you don't fear God if you're bluntly honest with him, if you lament, that you can't do that. Obviously, if you really feared God, then you would only speak words of praise, or only words of kind of level-headed petitions or whatever it might be.
Yeah, you should only be saying holy, holy, holy. No other words to God should come out of your mouth. Yeah, I think the idea here, and I think this still exists, Chad. It's one of the reasons that the Psalms are instructive, and of course Job is instructive. Is that you wouldn't talk to someone you fear like that.
Oh,
I
yeah.
mean, obviously, if you're going to talk to someone like that, like, you don't have any fear of them. And that is mostly coming from a place of not understanding what the fear of the Lord is,
Yeah,
right?
right. Yeah, it's a very small part of the bigger picture of what the fear of the Lord is. I mean, it's so the fear of the Lord is not just simply being afraid of God, but it's yeah, it's reverence, it's hope, it's faith, it's all of those things that are packed into that one idea. So you can fear God and cry out to him with words like Job has. You can fear God and also praise him. You can fear God and do anything within that spectrum. People do still have this idea, though. I'll get pushback sometimes when I talk about lament. Maybe it's a social media post or whatever it might be. And I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but people will say something like, I would never talk to God that way. And I always like to say, well, it's fine. But the psalmist did, Job did, people did all over the Bible. They talked to God like that. And they were those who feared God. Because the fear of the Lord is much more than simply being trembling and trepidatious before him.
Well, let me put it this way. Like, maybe this, I don't know if this is helpful at all, but if somebody says that I would never talk to God that way, which is like what they, and usually what they mean is in a candid way, in an honest way, what you're telling me is that I wouldn't talk to God as if I knew him. And that might sound harsh, but imagine you knew somebody. Imagine there's somebody. Now there's a situation that you could know. So there could be a person who is in has immense amounts of power. The governor. You meet the governor, and the first time you meet the governor, you realize this is somebody that has like a lot of power. They have a lot of power over you directly, and you probably treat them a certain way. You probably don't like. Well, I'm probably not gonna when I meet this person immediately insult them, or maybe I'm not gonna start. Talking bad about their wife or whatever, I'm not going to do that. That would seem like an imprudent thing to do. But imagine though, that the governor is actually someone that someone you know very well, someone who knows everything about you, and someone that's known you your whole life. And this is now someone who has told you that you can call them anytime and you could talk to them about anything. In fact, any need that you could possibly have, he not only says you can, but he desires you to like bring it before him. And this is somebody that is you're with every day. Well, now I think that you might talk to that governor differently, because it's not just the governor. This is someone that you have a relationship with. This is someone you have a history with. This is somebody that already knows, like maybe they knew you from when you were a kid. He knows all your weird stuff and your bad stuff, and you can have honest conversations with this person. Now, does that mean that this person doesn't have any power over you anymore? Does that mean that you don't have any respect for for the office that he holds? No, it doesn't mean that. But you speak to him as someone that you know. And I think that sometimes when people think about God, they don't think about talking to God as not just somebody that they know, but somebody who knows them best. There's no point in not being honest with God.
He already knows what you're thinking. So you just as well get the words out there.
And it seems that Job is the one who knows this, and his friends don't know this, where Job's like, what are you talking about? God sees all this. God's not leaving me alone. God knows everything. He's all powerful. What's the point in not being honest with him exactly? What is that? What's the point of that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the example you gave is great. And we all know this because the deeper the relationship we have with someone, the longer that we've known them, well, then that has a direct connection to how honest we were able to be with them.
Yep.
Yeah. So it certainly stands to reason that not only should we be that way toward God because of our connection to him in Christ, but also because he already knows. He
Yep.
knows what's in our heart. He knows what's in our mind. So, yeah, be honest when you pray. And let him know, just like Job. He's a paragon example of that. So first six verses, we've got a Job insulted and then told that he's turning people away from God. So not a good start to
by the
this
way,
chapter.
I do think that people, you might want to put a pin in this for like later on in Job, because not to give away the ending or anything, but when God is not real happy with Job's friends, I think it's things like this that he's really unhappy with. Like
Oh, yeah.
this sort of accusation right here is something you should remember when you see how God responds. When Eliphaz is telling Job that his problem is that he's done away with the fear of the Lord, and when he says that his own mouth has condemned him and his lips are going to testify against him, I think this is the kind of stuff that God's like, yeah, you're going to probably need Job to intercede for you. I think this is the sort of things that God, if God is, as Job says, has the book and he's like writing stuff down, I think these words made it in.
Probably so. Yeah. Yeah. God will save Job. He has spoken to me what is right. And you guys have not. And so you need him to pray for you. Verse 7. He's going to go on here to ask Job some questions. Are you the first man who was born? Or were you brought forth before the hills? Have you listened in the counsel of God? And do you limit wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that is not clear to us? Both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, older than your father. So he's pulling here upon kind of the antiquity, right? Are you drawing, Job, from some sort of, you know, ancient wisdom? Are you the first man who was born? Or do you have some sort of, you know, secret way of listening in on the counsel of God, basically? And of course, these are rhetorical questions. He's saying, no, you don't. You don't. You're not the first. You're not Adam. You're not the first man who was born. And you don't. You're not some sort of prophet who's able to sit in on the counsel of God. Everything you know, Job, we know. And of course, the implication is here that we know better than you do.
Do you
understand
get,
is clear to us.
Do you get the feeling that when Job's friends showed up and they started having this dialogue, as it progresses, they really don't know what to do with him?
Oh, like, yeah, they don't. They don't know what to do with him. And I think it shows in kind of the tone of frustration that
yeah.
you begin to see more and more. I think you don't start out insulting someone if you haven't grown a little bit frustrated with them.
Yeah.
You know, after a while, you're like, listen, idiot. You don't start out a conversation that way. You don't call them names until you've gotten to the point where you're like, you're a fool. You just don't understand. Or you're a windbag and you're just full of hot air.
But it almost feels like they're the type of people, and this still exists too, but you know, it's like they're used to believers and unbelievers, and believers and unbelievers would certainly talk about God differently, but they don't know. Like, Job is like a real conundrum for them, because it strikes me like they have never heard someone who is professing faith in God talk about God in this way. And this is they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, that is a problem with the friends throughout. I mean, they have these little cubicles, like you said, maybe two cubicles, believers, unbelievers. But they have other cubicles too. Like, okay, if you're in this, the cubicle of the good, the believer, well, then good things are going to happen to you. You know, But if bad things are happening to you, then logically, evidently, you're engaged in some sort of evil, or you committed some sin in the past that needs to be repented of. There's no room in their theological system for an innocent sufferer. Kind of what it boils down to. I have no theological category for that. And you'll see some of this in some of the other things that they say. They just are incapable of grasping the fact that someone can be innocent and suffer the way that Job is suffering. And so all they can resort to is just kind of beating that dead horse over and over and over. We'll confess your sins. What have you done? You reap what you
And
sow, kind of
stop
stuff.
talking about God that way.
Yeah, and start talking about God that way. Yeah, Job is a maverick. They don't know what to do with him. And so, because they don't have an argument, they tend to just insult, belittle, shout him down, or throw this their own word salads at Job, and hope that they're going to win the argument just by the accumulation of words.
And you have to, and you do wonder, like, okay, what's the thing here? Because why don't you just like walk away? Why don't you just be like, no, this guy's not gonna listen or whatever. It again, and I've said this numerous times, but I think it's true. I think this argument is almost them concerned that God is there's like a guilt by association thing. Like, this is their friend. And he's saying all these things, and they feel it is incumbent upon them to argue with him, lest God think that they are the same way, right? And so
Yes.
they're taking up God's defense, right? Like, oh, how dare you? Like the words out of your, the blasphemy, the irreverence, the I can't believe this, Job. And I have to give this big long response to you, lest God believe that I would not get his back in such matters. I can't let this stand. Am I supposed to sit here and listen to you talk about God this way and say these things? Well, I can't do that. If I walk away, God might think that I'm not interested in defending him, and then I might end up on a,
And
dust heap. I don't want that.
if these guys would live today and had social media accounts,
Oh,
man,
dear.
they would have a heyday. They'd be jumping on everybody's feed, correcting them and insulting them and
And I think
doing.
that all comes back to the Job, what Job says, like, you're not here out of love, you're here out of fear.
They're not there to comfort. They're to basically this is kind of a self-salvation project that they have. They're wanting to save themselves. We're not like you, Job, and we're going to make sure that God knows we're on his team by trying to correct you and rebuking you when you speak that which we deem to be improper. So we got these list of questions, and got one more to go here in verse 11. Are the comforts of God too small for you? Or the word that deals gently with you? Why does your heart carry you away? And why do your eyes flash that you turn your spirit against God and bring such words out of your mouth? Well, first of all, I don't know what these comforts of God that are too small for Job are all about. I mean, I suppose, yeah, he's still alive. He's breathing air, and presumably he's eating a little bit of food and water, but not a lot of divine comforts there in Job's life. So I don't. This accusation falls flat as far as I'm concerned. Oh, God is comforting you. Is that too small for you? Job would probably be like, well, if this is comfort, I'd sure hate to see when God comes after me.
Yeah, dude. He's probably like, yeah, with friends like this, who needs enemies, right? Like, good grief. What are you talking about? Also, like, I sure hope you guys showing up isn't the comfort of God, because no, that has been horrible.
No comfort there. Why does your heart carry you away, and why do your eyes flash against? Why do your eyes flash? Well,
What a dumb question.
yeah, it's like asking a guy who's like been dosed with water and he's standing outside and weather like you're experiencing, said, why are you cold?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder why. Why would that be happening to me? That you bring such words out of your mouth. Yeah, these guys just they can't handle the kind of honest prayer that Job is daring to speak to God. And then verse 14. What is man that he can be pure, or he who is born of a woman that he can be righteous? Behold, God puts no trust in his holy ones. I'm assuming he's talking about angels there. And the heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who is abominable and corrupt, a man who drinks injustice like water?
This is the truest thing that he said.
Yeah, this is one of these examples where these guys, you can't like, again, we don't fall in the same don't want to fall into the same trap that these guys have placed themselves in, where everything's black and white. Because, yeah, they say some things which are completely wrong. They say some things which are partially wrong and partially right. They say some things which are right. They're just wrong contextually.
Well, so, the answer to this is like, who said he did? Like this is one of those things like where, I mean, he's like, look, God doesn't put any trust in angels. Yeah, okay. Like, man can't be pure. Someone who's born a woman can't be righteous. Job's like, yeah, I know. Like, that's not, like, Job's argument is not like, I'm perfect. His argument is, I'm better than you, and look what's happening to me. The whole argument is that the proportionality, like, because he, I mean, you, like, they're not listening. Like, he's like, I'm saying that thieves right now are in their den counting their money. They're not on a trash heap scraping their boil. What I'm saying is that God hasn't, like, I'm not more unrighteous than those who aren't suffering. That's the whole argument.
Yeah. They keep throwing these theological words at him and thinking this is somehow going to undermine his argument. And Job's like, listen, we don't disagree about that. But it's not the point here. This is not what we're discussing. So he goes on, verse 17. I will show you, hear me, and what I've seen, I will declare what wise men have told without hiding it from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given and no stranger passed among them. So he's about to show him, he's about to drop some, you know, old traditional wisdom on him. I'm going to tell you what I've heard and known, what these old wise men have passed down from father to son. And that line in verse 19 about to whom alone the land was given and no stranger passed among them, I think that's basically saying there were no foreign influences that might have diluted this ancient wisdom. You know, this is pure stuff that I'm about to give you, Job. So open your ears, listen up. And here's what he says. Yeah, you think you're going to be like wowed by this this ancient wisdom he's about to drop on you. This is going to clear everything up, and Job is going to just, you know, kneel before his friends and say, "Okay, I give up. You're right." And it just this is definitely a word salad coming up. So verse 20, the wicked man writhes in pain all his days. Through all the years that are laid up for the ruthless, dreadful sounds are in his ears. In prosperity, the destroyer will come upon him. He does not believe that he will return out of darkness. He's marked for the sword. He wanders abroad for bread, saying, "Where is it?" He knows that a day of darkness is ready at hand. Distress and anguish terrify him. They prevail against him like a king ready for battle. Because he has stretched out his hand against God and defies the Almighty, running stubbornly against him with a thickly bossed shield, because he's covered his face with his fat and gathered fat about his waist, and has lived in desolate cities and houses that none could inhabit, which were ready to become heaps of ruins. I don't know if I should just keep reading this or not. This is all, he goes on and on, but if you're listening to kind of the flow of this, to me, it just comes across as ridiculous. Because, well, it's so contradictory to what we all know to be reality. Oh, yeah, the wicked man writhes in pain all his days. Dude, do you know any wicked men? Because I know some wicked dudes. I know some unbelievers. Let me tell you, they're not writhing in pain all day. I mean, many of them are experiencing a pretty good life. So
I feel like Job has already addressed this argument.
Yeah.
And, like, they completely ignored it. Like, because I feel like at the end of this, and he will just keep going. I mean, they will not be rich, his wealth will not endure, nor will he possess the land spread over the earth. He will not depart from his darkness. The flame will dry up his shoots. Let him not trust in emptiness, deceiving himself, for emptiness will be his payment, and it will be paid in full before his time, and his branch will not be green. He will shake off his unripe grape like the vine, and cast off his blossom like the olive tree. For the company of the godless is barren, and the fire consumes the tents of bribery. They conceive trouble and give birth to evil, and their womb prepares deceit. And I feel like at the end of all of this, Job would just go, no.
Yeah. Yeah. But he just shakes his head like, you guys are just piling up words that have absolutely no place in reality. This is not the way that it works.
No, like
Yeah,
obviously so.
I don't know. I don't know what kind of world these fellows are living in. It sounds like they're in some sort of a monastery where they have no connection to the real world.
Well, and you might want us to be like, so you guys gonna break down all this? There's nothing to break down here. Like what he's saying is like, hey, bad things happen to bad people. It's just that argument again. Like that,
Yeah,
like
that's all this is, right?
when people are wicked, horrible things happen to them. And Job's already said, but that's not universally true. Like sometimes bad things happen to bad people. Sometimes bad things happen to good people. Sometimes good things happen to bad people. Like sometimes good things I know this isn't true.
Yeah. These descriptions of the wicked man just are not true to reality. And all he does in all of those verses, that's verse 20 through 35. So for 15 verses, he just goes on using different images and different metaphors, some from nature, some from war, some from other things. Kind of even uses at the very end some language that you have in the prophets, as well as the Psalms, about conceiving trouble and giving birth to evil and their womb preparing deceit. I mean, you have that in different places in the Bible. But it all just is nothing more than an ongoing rehearsal of their same worn out argument that if good things are happening to you, you are good. If bad things are happening to you, you are bad. And Job's already addressed that. Everybody knows this who has lived in the real world, but these guys are either they're intellectually dishonest or they're just terribly naive about the way that this world operates. But either way, they're not going to break out of their kind of traditional wisdom categories where everything operates according to the category of if this happens, then this will happen. If you do good, good will fall to you. If you do bad, bad will come to you. But you know, that is, if you're like the three friends and you think that you're righteous and things are going well for you, this becomes a position that's easy to believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it makes you feel good about yourself. Well, my goodness, look at me. You know, I'm healthy. My family's doing great. I'm making money. But this guy over here, you know, three houses down, yeah, you know, his wife has cancer and his kids are a mess and he just lost his job, blah, 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 blah. So evidently, you know, what I'm doing is right and God's blessing me. Evidently what he's doing is wrong and God is taking him to task for it. Becomes a very kind of pat yourself on the back, break your arm doing it kind of self-righteous feel-goodism about about yourself.
Well, what's absent here is like obviously a theology of the cross. I mean, like this is all theology of glory kind of stuff, right? And what the cross really does come and just like shatter all of this. I mean, any if you're a Christian, the cross should completely obliterate all of these disillusions. Because obviously Christ is like the only one who is righteous, the only one who's pure, and he suffers immensely. And then you go and look at his church and his bride, and you look at the 12 people that he chose to build the church. They like, yeah, they had it sweet. Like it went great for them. Like they all like suffered and died horrible deaths. And so, yeah, this is obviously the work of Christ in the early church, like obliterates any thought that any of this is true.
Some of the metaphors in there are memorable, you know, like this guy, I love verse 26, running stubbornly against him with a thickly bossed shield. It's like this idea. You're like, bam, bam, bam. You're running against him. It's you're just bouncing off. But then he's got the whole, wherever the fat part is. I can't see those verses there, but yeah. Oh, I don't even know what this means. He's covered his face with his fat and gathered fat upon his waist.
Yeah,
So
triple chin, beer belly. That's every wicked person. You never saw a skinny wicked person. I know that.
Yeah, imagine reading the second half of Job 15 to Jesus while he's on the cross. Just see how that fits with the truthfulness. We got a few minutes left, so let's get into Job's response. And you got to love the ESV title to this chapter, Job 16. Job replies, miserable comforters are you. So this is that's the way it starts out. So verse 1 says, Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. It's one of my favorite lines in all of Job. Now, what's kind of cool about this, and you can't see this in translation, but the very last verse of the previous chapter, so the very last thing that Eliphaz is accorded as saying is, they conceive trouble. Now, in Hebrew, that's amal. They conceive trouble and give birth to evil. And the same word, the same Hebrew word, amal, is translated here as miserable. So you could even translate it as troublesome comforters are you all. Or you could just go back to the end of 30 of 15 and say they conceive misery and give birth to evil. But you get the idea. Job has received the insult and thrown it right back in Eliphaz's face.
Yeah, you have to wonder if this has anything to do with him saying, like, hey, are you despising the comforts of God? And he's like, I don't know. Is this some, are you guys some of those?
Because if you are, yes, I am despising them. I am rejecting them.
You consider yourselves among the many comforts that God has given me?
And then, I mean, he kind of continues this throwing things right back at him, because earlier, at the very beginning, of course, Eliphaz said that Job was a windbag, just full of hot air. And now Job says, shall windy words have an end? So we have a little rhetorical sparring going on back and forth here between these guys. Guys do like to trash talk each other. So this is, things have not changed a lot over the years. So shall windy words have an end? Or what provokes you that you answer? I also could speak as you do if you were in my place. I could join words together against you and shake my head at you. I don't know how to take verse 5 that I'm about to read. It's either Job being sincere and saying, hey, I could do a lot better job at this than you are, or it's Job being sarcastic. Anyway, he says, I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips would assuage your pain. Anyway, he basically says, listen, if the tables were turned and you were sitting here in the ash heap scraping sores off of your body, I could sit there and shake my head at you, and I could join all these words together, and I could talk like you're talking. It's not very difficult. But then I could also, unlike you, I could actually strengthen you with my mouth. And from my lips, I could give you some solace. At least that's the way that I'm reading that. I don't know that it's sarcastic. I think Job is saying, listen, I could talk, and then I actually could do a lot better job than you guys are doing, because I could actually give you some comfort.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Then he goes on. So verse 6, if I speak, my pain is not assuaged. And if I forbear, how much of it leaves me? So he can't win, more or less. If he talks, then he hurts. If he's silent, then the pain is still there. So silent or speaking, and nothing's going to change.
Well, you had an example of this. It's like, I don't know, you guys got here. We sat here for like a week, and there was no talking going on. So guess what? I was in immense pain. And now that we're talking, guess what? I'm still in immense pain. So does it really matter?
Only he's probably not a lot more agitated because he's had to deal with these guys. Now he's going to shift gears. Verse 7 through 9 are some pretty intense lament here. He's talking about what God has done to him. I guess he's decided that, hey, you know what? You don't like the way that I'm talking to God. You don't like the way I've talked to God so far. Well, just hide and watch what I got to say now.
Yeah, he just a little hold my beer, like, oh, you think I have I've don't have any fear of the Lord, and you don't like the way that I'm talking about him? Here, hold this and open up your ears wide for what's about to happen right now.
Yeah, so this is just 3 verses. Surely now God has worn me out. He, and the Hebrew there is actually you. It's more like a direct address to God, but you or he. Has made me desolate, has made desolate all my company. He has shriveled me up, which is a witness against me. My leanness has risen up against me, It testifies to my face. He has torn me in his wrath and hated me. He's gnashed his teeth at me. My adversary sharpens his eyes against me. Well, yeah, so if his friends were troubled beforehand by Job's, in their opinion, improper speech toward God, well, then there you go. There's that. I mean, you can't get much more honest than that.
Well, it seems like that. It was almost like he could take his friends and be like, Job, surely you're not blaming God for this. And Job's like, well, let me tell you exactly how much I'm blaming God for
this.
This
up for you. Yeah. So God's worn him out. He's made desolate all his company. Of course, Job did lose all his family, with the exception of Mrs. Job. Shriveled him up, witnessed against him. And Job, of course, is picking up on his physical condition here, where he says, my leanness has risen up against me. It testifies to my face. So he's kind of become a living icon of what happens when God attacks you, is what he's communicating here. And this is a kind of an animal image here. Verse 9, he's torn me in his wrath, gnashed his teeth at me. You know, gnashing teeth is like this. I always picture a wolf, it's snarling, it's showing its teeth and striking out, gnashing his teeth. And even says that God has hated him. Then he calls him his adversary and sharpening his eyes against him. What's that phrase we use in English? You look daggers at someone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the same idea here. Sharpen his eyes against me. You've all had like somebody look at you like, dang, if looks could kill, you just stab me to death right then. I think that's kind of what he's getting at here.
I think the hardest part of this, too, is just him coming right out and just saying, like, that God hates him. Right? This is how he interprets this, that I'm hated by God.
Yeah, man, unfortunately, Job is not the only one who's experienced that in the course of human history. If you interpret God's attitude toward you based upon painful external circumstances, then sometimes the conclusion people come to is either that God has turned his back on me, or doesn't care about me, or is actively hatefully attacking me.
Well, what also seems that it's true, you can correct me if I'm wrong here as we wrap up, Chad, but in the Old Testament, it seems that God's disposition towards you is viewed as pretty binary. That God, there is no like indifference on God's part. Job is like pleading for indifference, but it's not something that they believe exists. And so you'll see this like love and hate language happen a lot. I mean, maybe like the most famous version of it is Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. Does this mean that God actually hates Esau? You have God say of Jacob when it comes to Rachel and Leah that but he sees that Leah was hated. I mean, did Jacob really hate her? But in the Old Testament, those like it's one or the other. There's not like an in between. And so I think that's part of what's happening here is that Job is, if you have a binary choice, if it must be one of these options, if you're Job on the trash heap with the boils, your family's all gone, and you say, do you think that God loves you or hates you? And you have, and those, it's option A or B. Job is like, it appears to me that if those are the option, that God hates me.
Yeah. Oh, the binary choice is definitely the way that the Old Testament presents it. We see that all over the Psalms too, Yeah, this kind of love, hate, for or against. And I mean, in Job's defense, yeah, it's a pretty hard leap to be sitting there with the boils on the ash heap and looking over at the graves of all your kids and saying, God sure loves me.
Yeah.
But to go back to what we discussed just a few minutes ago, that is what the cross of Christ testifies. Does the Father love the Son? Absolutely. The Son's being crucified, and God loves us. And external circumstances don't dictate reality when it comes to God's attitude toward us. It's the cross that tells us what God thinks of us. And that cross testifies loud and clear that God is for us and not against us, and that he does love us, even though we go through these Job-like doubts and questions sometimes.
That's right. And we will have to leave it there. So we will continue next week with Job's response. He's got some more to say, not just in this chapter. Job is going to do what he has done many times and continue into the next chapter. And so we'll get into all that next week. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right. See you then.